afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics like mercury, PFAS, and pesticides are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is Mike Garfield, director of the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan, since 1993. The Ecology Center has a proud history since the 70s of grassroots advocacy campaigns to end lead poisoning. They promote recycling systems and test consumer products in their Healthy Stuff Lab. Recently, you may have seen their study in the news demonstrating the extent of PFAS in fish. But Mike is here today to help shine a light on greenwashing, in this case related to chemical recycling. Mike, thank you so much for joining me today on What Mama Wants.
Thanks for having me, Kate. It's great to be here.
Pleasure. Let's start with greenwashing. How do you explain this concept to curious people?
Well, people are familiar with whitewashing. They're familiar with brainwashing. When an oil company or a chemical company tries to persuade you that their product is good for you and good for the environment, that's greenwashing. You remember clean coal. What we're going to talk about today, I think, is about the greenwashing of recycling and the greenwashing of plastic.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking forward to talking more about it. I think you make a super important point. You have to pay attention to who's putting the information out. Recycling is so good, but then what if the information's coming from someone who has different ideas?
So I think we're becoming more and more sensitive to the sources of information that we rely on for news. And I think little by little, we're becoming better consumers of news and more aware generally of the messages that are coming at us. On the flip side, so are the public relations departments that work for private interests that may not have our best interests at heart. And some of the messages we receive and that sound really good, that tap into our values, the things we care about, they're getting more sophisticated year by year. And there is a long history in public health and environmental protection of noxious products being given a nice glossy sheen. I mean, it goes back to the tobacco industry, goes back to all sorts of problems that the chemical industry has had with one public relations problem after another that I think they've sought to clean up their image from. So if it wasn't reminding people about the wonders of plastic or the wonders of chemistry, and there are companies that advertise about the marvels of their products, you've got to read the fine print and understand what message people are really trying to convey.
Yeah, I think teaching children now really has to include discerning messages, because they are bombarded with such professional messages on both sides. You have to sort it out.
One of the greatest examples of this is a renaming that took place, maybe 30 years ago, about the products that come out of our sewage treatment systems.
Biosolids?
Well, exactly. What we used to call sewage sludge, which isn't just the product we flush down our toilets and down our drains. Those sewage treatment plants, especially in urbanized areas, but all over the country, also contain all sorts of industrial byproducts that come out of factories and are meant to be treated in those sewage treatment plants, but something comes out of them, a sludge. And sewage sludge seemed like not the kind of thing that you'd want to be taking anywhere, much less spreading on farm fields or turning into a commercial fertilizer, which is what happens to some sewage sludge right now. It has for a long time.
It's a big issue here in Maine. We stopped spreading sludge. We were the first state to stop spreading sludge. And now we have to figure out what to do with the biosolids. You know, if you're not going to spread them, you have to figure out where you are going to put them.
Yeah, it's a problem. And there are industrial chemicals in it. We've tested commercial fertilizers that rely on sewage sludge for their feedstock. And we found significant levels of PFAS and other chemicals in that product. And it is an ongoing problem. But the industry decided to use the term biosolids. And with their advertising dollars, they were able to persuade other industries and in the public to use it.
It's a good example of greenwashing too. You know, they put the dried biosolids into bags and sell it to people called mill organite. And it sounds like it's organic, must be good, and you pay money. And it's Milwaukee people's poo.
It's the Milwaukee Sewer District. And it sounds organic, doesn't it?
It sounds so good. It says don't put it anywhere near a drain. Yeah.
Exactly.
So we have an epic problem globally as we're awash in plastics and now microplastics, with more plastic production plants being built even as we speak. There is a huge need to figure out what to do with old plastic. And now there's a process called chemical recycling, or plastics to fuel technology, in which plastics get melted down and repurposed.
I think we have to step back a little bit and just think about that term itself, a chemical recycling. That's the equivalent of biosolids in this case. That's the industry's term for what used to be called pyrolysis, gasification, and other industrial waste conversion technologies. They've been around for a long, long time, but the plastics industry is now marketing these technologies as something brand new. In some places, they call it chemical recycling. In other places, they call it advanced recycling or even molecular recycling. And they're seeking regulatory favors, public investments to promote it. But I've worked on recycling a long time. And you mentioned before, my organization founded the first recycling program in the state of Michigan and one of the first in the country. And I care about good recycling and real recycling. And chemical recycling is not recycling. Just straight out, it's greenwashing. I think some of your listeners probably remember when recycling was a little bit more straightforward some years ago, when there were fewer plastic packaging products on the market. Recycling was mostly a matter of collecting and reprocessing paper, metals, and glass. Eventually, we started collecting and processing clear plastic bottles, maybe some milk jugs. Those all have pretty well-established markets. The prices go up and down, the value goes up and down, like any commodities. But the process is well understood. The materials can be sorted from one another. It's a process that markets have developed around, and that the whole infrastructure to collect and operate the system has been established over decades. But in the last 25 years, things have changed, and changed in dramatic fashion. The plastics industry has designed all sorts of new products, new packaging, some for convenience, some because they want to make use of their feedstocks, oil and gas, which is being phased out as transportation fuels and as heating fuels and for other purposes. And as we try to deal with the climate crisis and phase out oil and gas, the industries are looking for new products and new markets. And they've focused on plastics as the big new growth market. So we've got all these new packaging items that have come on the market. There's been no thought put to what happens to them at the end of life. The plastic packaging manufacturers haven't consulted with recyclers about how to design those products, how to recycle them. And so we've got a whole slew of new items out here and no idea what to do with them. And it's caused all sorts of problems for recyclers. You hear a lot these days about problems with recycling, sorting out materials from one another. You hear, I think environmentalists even wonder if the whole practice is worth it or not. And the truth be told, most of the problems with recycling are not problems with recycling. They're problems with plastics. Plastics complicate the process of sorting out papers, other materials, and they're hard to sort from one another. So what the industry has come up with is some technologies that they're trying to promote to manage these new packaging materials, and they're urging states and the federal government to try to deregulate them, provide public investment for these facilities. But what they mostly do is they mostly use high heat technologies to turn plastics and other waste products into fuel, and then it gets burned in different sorts of facilities. And when you burn plastics, no matter what's happened to them in the interim period, when you burn plastics, you're burning fossil fuels, and that's creating carbon emissions that worsen the climate crisis. It's also creating emissions of many different sorts, depending on what kind of plastic has come into the mix and what sort of additives have been added to the resins that comprise those plastics.
This would definitely not fall into the clean energy category.
It's not clean energy. It's not recycling.
Last December in 2022, your governor, Whitmer, in Michigan, signed a bill to reclassify such incinerators that melt down plastic. And now they're renaming them into manufacturing, a little more greenwashing, I think. And thus, that effectively removes the regulations that protected people and the earth from the toxic air pollution being belched out at these incinerators. And beyond thinking, yikes, I wonder who exactly benefits from making these things.
Well, the bottom line of oil, gas, and petrochemical companies is what benefits from all this. But I think we need to understand what the bigger strategy is here. As the industry is trying to roll out this old technology for new purposes, they're running into roadblocks in federal and state laws. Under federal law, these sorts of facilities are regulated as incinerators, and there are fairly strict air pollution controls and regulations that attend to having those facilities permitted and how they have to operate. At the state level, most states treat incinerators and these facilities as solid waste facilities, like landfills and full trash incinerators. Most states have a process which allows a significant amount of community input into the siting of landfills and incinerators, with good reason. I mean, who wants to live near one of those facilities? And what industry has been trying to do is to remove those regulations. So at the federal level, there's a process underway right now that would release the plastics industry from these Clean Air Act regulations for pyrolysis facilities and other so-called chemical recycling facilities. At the state level, the industry's trying to do what they did in Michigan last year, where they're trying to remove these solid waste requirements in solid waste law. So what happened in Michigan has happened in 20 other states already. And in those states, these facilities no longer have to get solid waste permits. They may have to get other permits in those states, but they're not as rigorous as the permits they used to have to receive. We're trying to reverse that action that took place last year. Our legislature flipped from Republican to Democrat for the first time in decades in November. So this was one of the parting gifts that the outgoing legislature left us with.
I think it's really worth mentioning. It's something that can happen without too much attention being paid to it, which can change the game a lot. You know, these chemicals such as benzenes and lead, cadmium, chromium, they go up in the air and then they go into our bodies and our soil, our water. It's so hard to clean up.
There are only a handful of these pyrolysis facilities that are operating in the United States right now for the purpose of processing plastic and other waste from households and businesses. Technology is used in industry a little bit more for industrial byproducts. But the Natural Resources Defense Council last year conducted a study of 8 of those facilities that are processing plastic waste. They found that most of them are converting the waste into fuel, that just one of them generates 500,000 pounds of hazardous waste every year, and that there are all sorts of toxic byproducts that come from the operation of those facilities, and most of them are located in communities of color and low-income communities.
Plastics is just a problem from inception forever.
You know, the industry is reacting to this disappointment that all of us have, that this great solution that my organization and lots of other organizations and people have championed for decades, recycling. The industry has reacted to the fact that most plastics don't get recycled. And they're trying to come up with a way to convince people that they can. But the real solution for us never was just recycling. Remember the old kids model, reduce, reuse, recycle. And you might add some other things now, like repair and compost and other things. But the first principles were to reduce the amount of materials that you waste and reuse and repair what you can. And that gets lost in all of these discussions. And if we move immediately to what do we do with the end product without thinking of how the material was designed in the first place, we've got some real problems. And we've got a lot of other problems with recyclability. Everyone needs to understand that just because something is technically recyclable doesn't mean that it's really recyclable or that it's going to get recycled. Just because you might buy toothpaste if in a container that says it's made of recycled polypropylene doesn't mean that that material can be recycled. It may have the chasing arrows, the three arrows on it with a number inside it that says 2 or 5 or something that gives you the impression that it's recyclable. But those chasing arrows don't mean that that product's recyclable. It simply identifies what kind of resin, what kind of plastic resin the product is made of. That really needs to be better understood. And likewise, the notions of marketing a product as recyclable needs tougher laws that actually let people know that something's recycled in the real world, that it can actually be collected by your curbside collection truck or some kind of program to drop off materials or collect materials near where you live. There needs to be a way of sorting that material from the other stuff that it gets combined with. There needs to be a way to actually turn it into some usable end product so that it really achieves what it was meant to achieve, which is to keep the raw material in the ground. Too often, these plastic products end up getting recycled into something that we don't have a whole lot of use for, and you need to produce new plastic bottles or milk jugs or flexible pouches, the plastic toothpaste container.
Yeah. So more transparency so that the actual consumers can get a feel for what is actually recyclable and not. It looks like US PERG's taking this up. I just got an email from them yesterday about this very point.
Yeah. Truth in recycling is a critically important issue that's being considered in some states. There are industry groups that are genuinely trying to find some answers to this too and have started dialogue about this. There are a lot of companies that want to do the right thing, and it's been a struggle. This is a complex area, and there aren't strong federal laws that make it easy for individuals to know what's the right thing to do or for a lot of companies to know how they're going to provide products that are really green in packaging that are really reusable or recyclable or compostable.
More clarity, more transparency. It would be great. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Mike Garfield, director of the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The Ecology Center dates way back to 1970, from the very beginning of the first Earth Day, says that chemical recycling can't solve our problem with plastics, and that the people most in harm's way are often people from lower income neighborhoods who haven't had as much choice about siting. So this practice also represents issues of equity, poverty, racial injustice as well. You hinted at that before, but I wondered if you could say more about our growing awareness about racial justice.
Well, I'll give you a real world example. The Ecology Center and a number of other environmental organizations, community organizations, neighborhood groups, for years fought an incinerator that operated in the city of Detroit. It was located in a neighborhood with high levels of asthma, low income, predominantly Black. And the community wanted what everyone else wants. They want clean air. They wanted to be able to go outside without breathing in a brew of chemicals. We worked with them and learned that the facility had violated its air permit hundreds of times in the space of a couple of years. And over the course of many years, people came together throughout that neighborhood and throughout the larger region to demand cleaner solutions. And eventually the facility was shut down. There are facilities of this sort, incineration facilities, pyrolysis facilities, manufacturing facilities that are part of the materials and waste system located all over the country. And if you study where these facilities are located, they're overwhelmingly located in communities of color. They're overwhelmingly located near low-income neighborhoods. And it's absolutely critical that as new facilities get proposed, that there is some consideration brought to who's going to bear the brunt of any air and water pollution and other problems that might attend to these facilities. When these facilities are proposed, they also need to be considered in light of the other neighboring facilities that also generate air pollution and other sorts of community impacts. Usually, when facilities are proposed to be permitted, the environmental and public health regulations that guide whether or not the state or federal law allows them to be opened, they look at what's produced there in a vacuum and simply look at the amount of air pollution that may come from that one facility without keeping in mind that right down the block, there might be another major facility whose chemicals interact with the air pollutants coming from the new proposal. And that combination might lead to an even greater cumulative impact for the people who live nearby.
That's such an important point. It reminds me a lot of medical prescriptions. You know, people get prescribed something without a lot of attention to what they're already taking, and the cocktail ends up being sickening.
And when you hear the advertisements for those drugs, you'll hear about what you shouldn't take it with and what the side effects may be. We don't hear about that when proposed air polluting and water polluting facilities are being cited.
No, we don't hear much about that, do we? So, Mike, as the director of an ecology center, what would you say Mother Earth might want regarding toxics and human health at this point?
You know, I don't know what Mother Earth would want, but I think what everyone wants is to be able to live their life without having to worry about toxic chemicals in the stuff of our daily life. We don't want to have to worry that the things we buy in the store, the food, the packaging, the materials might be loaded with lead, mercury, phthalates, brominated flame retardants, and a whole slew of other toxic chemicals. We just want to be with our families and our friends and do the things that we love to do. I think more than anything else, we deserve to have laws and communities that protect us from things that we shouldn't have to get an advanced degree in chemistry to learn about, not to mention do all the research on what every single product contains.
Less toxics, more health. I'm right there with you. To close this interview, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions about your personal relationship to the environment, if you're game for a little fun.
Oh, let's go. Sure.
As a kid, what was your favorite thing to do outside in nature?
Oh, I was a sports kid. I grew up in New York City. We moved to the Midwest when I was 10, but I have this memory of the outdoors as being the place you'd go to play. And that's my memory of it.
Right on. Can you describe a scene in nature when you have felt real awe?
Oh, that's a great question. There is a place in northern Michigan on sand dunes that overlook Lake Michigan that are so dramatic. People who live on the east or west coast think they're looking at the ocean when they see this for the first time. I remember going to a place on those sand dunes in the winter on cross-country skis and reaching what seemed to be the end of the earth. there was snow whipping in our face, and the vast expanse of Lake Michigan lay before us. And you know how the snow just transforms the landscape for you. For me, I thought I'd reached one of the poles, and I was just a few hours' drive from where I live every day.
It's epic scale.
The Great Lakes are underappreciated. They're an extraordinary part of the world.
Well, thanks for that image. It's beautiful and wild. What's one thing you currently wonder about in nature?
I've been fascinated by some of the work on biomimicry and efforts that a lot of brilliant people are making right now to try to find ways to create the things of modern life, mimicking the processes of nature through what sometimes gets called green chemistry or other processes. I'm not a scientist, but I absolutely love the way some of the folks that are working on these efforts look at the world. They're trying to adapt all of the principles, all of what we've learned through the centuries, and apply it in a values-first way to live cooperatively with nature.
And what is your favorite baby animal?
I just love a little puppy. Doesn't love a little puppy.
They're irresistible, reminding us why we do what we do. Mike, for 30 years, you worked with policymakers, innovators, corporations, and citizens to answer the question, how can we continue to thrive without destroying our Earth's ability to sustain us? And I want to thank you for carrying the water on this heavy uphill journey. It can be overwhelming at times, but you keep bringing the answers and possibilities. So sincerely, thank you for your substantial contributions, educating us all, and for being my guest today on What Mama Wants.
Thanks so much, Kate. Thank you for getting the word out and all the communications work that you're doing.
It's my pleasure. If you want to learn more about the Ecology Center, it's ecocenter.org. There's so many great resources there.